Welcome back to the CritMedic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallensack. You know, I have a reputation for thinking differently and marching to the beat of my own drum. Sometimes people tend to look at me like I'm downright crazy. Be that as it may, I do things that are based on evidence and science. And sometimes, science may seem like madness to the uninitiated. Since this has come up a couple of times already, I figured I would share this with everyone so that I get a few less perplexed glares from people and questions from other providers. And, if you haven't heard of this before, I hope I can provide you with something new and informative this week. But first, let me start off with an anecdote. I worked a cardiac arrest not too long ago where I was blessed with not being the sole paramedic on scene. Usually we run sole paramedic or get a supervisor a little while into the code. But that wasn't the case with this particular call. We actually got a paramedic from a different agency with us as well. And it was really great to see providers from different companies coming together, putting aside interagency conflicts and politics, to work together to try and save a patient's life. Anyways, without bothering you with the boring details, we got ROSC relatively quickly. Yay! Unfortunately, the patient remained apneic. So, we had to secure the airway on top of delivering ventilation and oxygenation. Well, I dug into my bag of paramedic tricks, and guess what I dug out? Apneic oxygenation. Now, at this point, some of you are probably scratching your head, going, "Apno what?" Others are going, "Preach it, my brother man." Anyways, I have the fire department place the patient on 10 to 15 liters per minute of oxygen while they weren't breathing, by a nasal cannula. Of course, the other ALS provider on scene was like, "What are you doing, dude? He's not breathing. He doesn't need that." If you're not already on board the high-flow nasal oxygen cannula apneic oxygenation train, I'm going to ask you to suspend your disbelief for just a moment and allow me to explain. When we were all taught as fresh EMTs, we probably were taught that a nasal cannula goes from 2 to 6 liters per minute and a non-rebreather goes from 12 to 15 liters per minute, and they're not interchangeable. And for the purposes of your state and national registry tests, that is correct. But we have to look beyond what we're initially taught to science and benefits. Let's talk about some benefit. Why do we put someone on oxygen? Because they're having problems with oxygen delivery to the tissues. And primarily, there are two ways we can improve oxygenation: increased FiO2 and increased PEEP. When we talk about PEEP, or peak end expiratory pressure, we are generally talking CPAP masks or devices in the pre-hospital setting, or PEEP ventilator settings in the critical care interfacility setting. PEEP increases oxygen delivery by recruiting more alveoli for gas exchange that would have otherwise been lost to atelectasis. Also, by increasing the pressure, you also increase the number of oxygen molecules in the alveoli for gas exchange, also known as Avogadro's law. Increasing the pressure of the air you breathe means that the number of molecules you breathe in is higher. It's also why, above 10,000 feet, we encounter issues with oxygenation, because there's not enough molecules entering the alveoli at that pressure. Hence why pilots, and I guess passengers too, but they're less critical, wear supplemental oxygen if their aircraft depressurizes at altitude. Not because the percentage of oxygen in the air has decreased, it's still about 21%, but because the amount of air has decreased. So anyways, why all this talk of PEEP? I thought we were talking about cannulas, right? Well, as it so turns out, a nasal cannula generates positive pressure. If paired with a BVM with a PEEP valve or poor man's CPAP like an OxyPEEP, we actually generate about 5 centimeters of water pressure. Some sources suggest as high as 6 to 8 centimeters of pressure, with a nasal cannula set at 15 liters. So, with a nasal cannula, you can give some positive airway pressure. Look at infants in the NICU. They have nasal CPAP masks. It's a similar, though not quite identical, principle. So, PEEP is one aspect, but it's not really the main aspect. The main way that the nasal cannula provides excellent benefit is by generating positive flow into the nasal pharynx and hypopharynx. It's not blowing around outside their face or going around the edges of the mask and exhalation holes on the mask. It's being directly delivered, or projected if you will, right into their nasal pharynx. If you remember, when you have an adult with a normal tidal volume of, say, about 500 milliliters, about 30% of that volume, around 150 milliliters, is dead space air. Air that's in the hypopharynx, trachea, and bronchial tree. That's air that's first into the alveoli, and also air that really hasn't had much benefit from the non-rebreather blowing at the face of the patient. But when you put the nasal cannula on at 10 to 15 liters, you generate some positive laminar flow of oxygen through the nasal pharynx and mixing with the air in the hypopharynx. This gives your patient oxygen-rich air right at the level of the glottis. And this oxygen-rich air diffuses down into the trachea and bronchi so that there's continuous ongoing oxygenation. This happens because oxygen is continuously loaded into the bloodstream, but not that much carbon dioxide is offloaded during apnea, which leads to the creation of a slight vacuum at the level of the alveoli, which draws in oxygen-rich air at the glottic opening. So, what does that mean for us? From a practical application standpoint, what can apneic oxygenation do for us? It means that you can put a nasal cannula on a patient you're about to intubate, either via non-rebreather, CPAP, or BVM, while you pre-oxygenate them. And when I say pre-oxygenate, I don't mean 30 seconds and off. You really need to provide at least 1 minute, and really preferably 3 minutes of oxygenation, because the goal is not just to get them to 100% saturation, although that is part of it. It's also about denitrogenation, to replace all the dissolved and dead space nitrogen with oxygen to provide the patient with that much more of an oxygen reserve. And when you are ready to intubate, keep that nasal cannula going on high flow. This will buy you extra time during your intubation to do calm, progressive laryngoscopy in a non-hurried, non-frenzied fashion. This whole old wives' tale, or old medic's tale, of holding your breath while intubating, because if you can't breathe, neither can your patient. Well, that's not entirely true. This nasal oxygen buys us quite a bit of extra time. How much time are we talking about? Well, in a healthy 70 kilogram adult, they can maintain arterial saturation at or above 80, which is the threshold of hypoxia in terms of blood gas, for about 8.7 minutes. Realistically, how many healthy 70 kilogram adults are we actually intubating? Probably not that many. So-called moderately ill adults of the same weight reach an SaO2 of 80 after just 5.5 minutes. And on a side note, succinylcholine wears off after 6.8 minutes at the earliest, which is in only 10% of the patients studied. So the argument in favor of succinylcholine as your choice of paralytic is rather fallacious. Anyways, when you look at it further, an obese 127-kilogram adult desaturates to an SaO2 of 80 in 3.1 minutes, which is even faster than you would see in a 10-kilogram child. And you know how quickly children decompensate. When we use the nasal cannula apneic oxygenation method, we can extend that by many minutes. In fact, in a study of healthy volunteers undergoing surgery for minor procedures, they found that they could maintain arterial saturation for as long as 53 minutes. By the way, in the subject who went the full 53 minutes, the lowest his saturation dropped was 98%. For being in respiratory arrest for 53 minutes, that's fantastic. However, it should also be noted that the patients who went really long periods of time with apneic oxygenation were, unsurprisingly, profoundly acidotic and hypercapnic. While, generally speaking, that's not too bad, it's actually sort of okay in patients who maintain adequate saturation because of the right shift in the oxyhemoglobin disassociation curve that takes place with acidosis. That is, when someone is very acidotic, that metabolic state makes it even easier for oxygen to be offloaded from the blood into the tissues. And at any rate, our goal is not to see if we can keep them oxygenated through almost an hour of apnea, but rather to buy ourselves just a little bit of extra time to secure that airway via endotracheal tube, supraglottic airway, surgical means, without inducing hypoxia. If we can extend the obese patient from 3 minutes to 10 minutes worth of oxygenation, then we've benefited them by preventing hypoxia during the procedure. In fact, a 2010 study on obese patients showed that the time to desaturation increased to over 5 minutes by just the application of 5 liters per minute by nasal cannula. And it's really hypoxia and hypotension that kills and injures in intubation, especially in trauma patients with potential head injuries. Hypoxemia and hypotension are killers, ones that are potentially within our realm of control. We need to prevent the laryngoscope from being used as a murder weapon. In fact, I suggest you check out the MCRIT podcast on the laryngoscope as a murder weapon. I'll post a link down in the show notes. So, to recap this far, I've explained how nasal cannula at 10 to 15 liters per minute can improve a patient's oxygenation by entraining oxygen-rich air from the nasopharynx and hypopharynx down into the bronchial tree and alveoli during respiration. And by doing this, we can keep someone oxygenated, even when they're not breathing. But that's not all we can do. We still have some more tricks up our sleeves. We should also be sitting the patient up. Not a lot, but a 20-degree head elevation has been shown to increase the time to desaturation by 25% in adults and almost 33% in obese adults. This slight semi-Fowler's, or reverse Trendelenburg position, has been shown to decrease the risk of aspiration. Furthermore, aligning the ear canal with the sternal notch in the same plane has been shown to facilitate intubation by ideally positioning the patient's anatomy. Let's not forget our airway adjuncts here, too. Go ahead and place not just an OPA, but go ahead and place your NPAs as well. That's right, splint open all your air holes. Why not? With proper placement technique, the trauma is really minimal. You encourage better ventilation, and with the nasal cannula, you get even smoother flow straight back into the hypopharynx. And last point I'd like to make is to abandon the EC clamp or EC technique for bag mask seal. I had the opportunity to attend the difficult airway course not too long ago, and one of the takeaways I picked up was the two thumbs down technique. In fact, Dr. Weingart and Dr. Strayer mentioned it in their podcasts and vodcasts as well. I don't think I could hope to explain it anywhere near as well as they do, so I'll put a link down in the show notes for that as well. But let me summarize it by explaining that grasping both sides of the mandible with four fingers and pulling it up into the mask, which is held down by two fingers pointed inferiorly, give you better airway opening and better mask seal. Because the tendency of the EC clamp technique is to mush that mask down into the patient's face, and that often flexes the head forward and reduces airway clearance. Whereas the two thumbs down technique encourages you to pull the face and mandible up into the mask. It's like a built-in mask seal and jaw thrust all in one. Just be aware that while you can do this as a sole provider, it's ideal when used as a two-person bagging technique, depending on your space limitations at the patient's side. Speaking of limitations, that's all the time we have for this week. We've covered what apneic oxygenation and no desat are, so if someone is using it on a scene near you, you can say, "Hey, I recognize that. Some random guy on the internet was talking about that." Or, on second thought, "That sounds kind of bad." Just point them to the resources, studies, and data included in the show notes for this podcast, and hopefully the science will speak for itself. If you think you or someone you know would have some good content that you'd like to share on this podcast, let me know. There's more than enough knowledge and material out there to cover a wide range of topics, and we'd love to have them on our show. Until next time, Crit Medic listeners, keep thinking differently.